This is a special bonus episode of Judaism Unbound, The Orchard, on History and the Bible. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson, and I'm excited to release another podcast episode about The Orchard, the Israeli novel by author Yochi Brandis that I had the privilege to be the translator of. And we're really excited to release another interesting discussion, this time on my favorite podcast, History in the Bible, with host Gary Stevens, who was really interested in talking about the subject matter covered by The Orchard, the dawn of Rabbinic Judaism, because it happens around the same time as the dawn of Christianity, and it's a great way to look into the reasons and the ways in which Judaism and Christianity diverged in the early days after the destruction of the Second Temple. The History in the Bible podcast looks at the history behind all of the episodes in the Bible, starting from the Hebrew Bible, which it just wrapped up, and all the way through the New Testament, which it's currently just beginning. I want to report a few things about The Orchard since our last episode on it. It's gotten some great reviews, including a star review in Publishers Weekly, which is a rare event, and we're really excited about that. I also want to note that today, as this podcast goes up, March 20th, 2018, the book is currently free on Kindle for a few days. And so if you're interested in reading The Orchard and you like reading on Kindle, you should rush to Amazon and download it free. It's going to be a very limited time offer. And if you do like it, we really hope you'll give it a 5-star rating and write a review on Amazon, because that'll help a lot of other people find the book. So we hope you'll enjoy this additional discussion of The Orchard on the History of the Bible podcast. And we're really grateful to Gary Stevens for doing this interview with me and also for allowing us to release the podcast on our feed. So without further ado, The Orchard on History and the Bible.
G'day, I'm Gary Stevens, and welcome to the second series of the History in the Bible podcast. More of the history in more of the books in all the Bibles. In this bonus episode, I want to welcome back to the podcast Daniel Liebenson. Dan is a Harvard law graduate and former law professor. He is the founder and president of the Institute for the Next Jewish Future. Dan is a prolific writer and lecturer, a passionate activist who's determined to stir things up. He is the co-host of the Judaism Unbound podcast. While he's been doing all that, Dan found time to translate best-selling Israeli author Yochi Brandis' latest novel into English. In a previous episode with Dan, we discussed Yochi's earlier novel, The Secret Book of Kings, about the earliest kings of Israel, Saul and David and Solomon. Yochi upended the old biblical stories to show us the history that the losers might have written. Yochi's new novel is The Orchard. This time, Yochi has evoked the turbulent era after the Roman destruction of the Temple and Jerusalem in the year 70. The Jews were a people whose social structures, whose identity, whose great festivals, whose theology were founded on the sacred temple in the sacred city. The Romans crumbled that bedrock. Yochi's novel tells us how the rabbinic sages reinvented Judaism, while another path was taken by the Jesus clubs of Paul of Tarsus. In The Orchard, Yochi delivers her own unique take on the times. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Gary. It's so great to be back on again.
Okay. Now, Dan, what is the significance of this period in history? What's going on? And also, what specific period of history are we talking about? Why set a novel in this period?
Yeah, so the period that the novel is set in is around the year 100 or so CE or AD. And but the novel also has flashbacks to the time around the destruction of the Second Temple, so in the 60s and 70s CE, and also the book sort of goes up until the end of the major Jewish revolt against the Romans, known as the Bar Kokhba Revolt, which was about the year 135, and a little bit beyond that as well. That's the critical turning point in Jewish history, where the Judaism as we know it today was initially formed, because prior to that time, Judaism was this religion that was centered on the temple in Jerusalem, where the practice was essentially various sacrifices that were brought, whether they were sacrifices of grains or sacrifices of animals, and the rituals were conducted by the priests who were hereditary people who got their positions through heredity, and they really just had a much more of a cultic approach to religion, and not at all the Judaism that we sort of think of today that has to do with prayer in a synagogue and study of texts. That Judaism was formed after the destruction of the Second Temple. And really, when we say the word Judaism, and this is really, I think, was a big part of Yochi's agenda, that writing in Israel, where the secular Israelis often learn the stories of the Bible, but they don't learn very much about the stories of the rabbis and of the Talmud period, which is this period and later. And Yochi was kind of trying to say, look, the Bible stories are really important and they're great and everything, but that's not really what we mean when we say Judaism. That is kind of the pre-Judaism, the prehistory. When we talk about Judaism, we're talking about the religion that the rabbis created. And so it's important to understand that period and the beginning of that period. And that's what she's trying to accomplish here. And one of the elements that she's trying to really emphasize in the book is the revolution that was going on, that what the rabbis did ultimately was, you know, that it wasn't just some kind of tweaking of that sacrificial cult in a time where after the temple was destroyed, okay, maybe we'll make sacrifices here and there in different places. It was a total revolution where Judaism was completely redesigned. And a lot of people, Jews and non-Jews, don't necessarily realize just how much of a break and how much of a revolution there was between, you know, Judaism version 1 and Judaism version 2.
Yes, this is really a radical reinvention, isn't it? I mean, it's the biggest reinvention since Ezra's time and the return from Babylon.
Absolutely. And it's hard to even know because the history is so sketchy that we don't really even know exactly how much even of reinvention there was back then in the time of Ezra, but seemingly quite substantial. But even then, the practice was largely still around the temple or around sacrifices. And the idea of, you know, whatever the religion of Israel was, it largely had to do with ceremonies that took place at temples or a temple or altars of various kinds. And so this revolution is an enormous revolution that says, you know, we don't do any of that stuff anymore. And now this is going to be solely about worship, prayer, and about words, about study, about how do we conduct our daily lives. And that's profoundly different Judaism from one that's primarily built around sacrificial rites.
Right. Now, the centrality of the temple. Now, I'm just thinking, if St. Peter's Basilica was blown to bits, it would not cause a theological revolution in Catholicism, but the destruction of the temple did. Why was the temple? Now, you've outlined a bit of it, but the sheer centrality of the temple to Jews, not only in Israel, Judah, but throughout the Mediterranean of the Roman Empire, it was the pivot point of Judaism, wasn't it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Yeah, I would say yes and no, right? So because we know from the evidence, right, that the temple was destroyed and Judaism didn't go away. So there was a nascent alternative, you know, right? The rabbis didn't invent it out of nothing starting in the year 70. There was something going on, perhaps as early as Ezra's return from the Babylonian exile, or the earlier returnees from the Babylonian exile. And there was some alternative Judaism going on that was in the air that just wasn't fully solidified. So there was something out there, but it is important to indicate, and I think you cover this in the History in the Bible episodes about this period, that towards the end of the period before the Babylonian exile, there was this increasing understanding of the centrality of the temple and the centrality of Jerusalem in Jewish practice, right? That prior to that, there were altars all over the place, and you could bring sacrifices, and there were priests and Levites that would do their ceremonies in different places all over the country. And over the course of time, there was really this religious revolution which centralized the practice in Jerusalem. The good part about that, I guess, if you're a priest or if you're a king, is that, you know, you kind of can get the taxes all into one place. The bad part about it is that if it gets destroyed, the whole thing is gone. So I think that really the first crisis of that nature was the Babylonian exile, in the sense of, you know, the psalm that says, you know, how can we sing to the Lord in a foreign land, really comes from the idea that we just finished a revolution of our whole religion that said that the only place we can do anything for the Lord is in Jerusalem. So there was this initial, you know, struggling to say, well, what kind of Judaism can exist outside of Jerusalem? And so some of that work, I think, got done in that period. But towards the end of the Second Temple period, I think the last 100 years or so, primarily spurred on by Herod and his sort of grandiose building projects, was another effort to centralize everything in Jerusalem, I think largely for political reasons. And so when that was destroyed, it was yet another of those kind of crises. You know, again, I think what's really interesting is that the centralization in Jerusalem before the destruction of the First Temple, that was only happening for, you know, you tell me 100 years or less, you know, and right before the destruction of the Second Temple, you know, it had only been centralized in the last 100 years or so before then. So, you know, the sort of tragedy of it is that these destructions tend to happen, you know, just as Judaism has reconfigured itself to be centralized around Jerusalem. Maybe that's why it happens, you know, because it seems to tend to lead to some kind of fanaticism that then causes, you know, some kind of unwise relations with the dominant power.
Right. Now, parallel to the system of the priesthood and the temple, in this period, I think starting from mid-Hellenistic times, we find synagogues appearing. As far as I know, the earliest synagogue that we have evidence of is dated, it's from Egypt, and I think it's from the reign of the Second Ptolemy. So we have these little synagogues popping up. They're not at all connected with the temple, are they?
No, and I'm not really a big expert on this, but we had a guest on our podcast a few months ago who's a historian named Barbara Tita, and she was really pointing out that when there are synagogues that are around in that time when the temple is still standing, there are no rabbis yet. By definition, the rabbis only sort of come about at the time after the destruction of the temple. So what was going on in these synagogues at that time? Who was leading them? Were they, you know, and her point of view is that they weren't services that were going on there. The synagogues were more like kind of community centers where the Jews who were in these diaspora communities could get together, could do some business together, could just have social get-togethers. Maybe there was some kind of religious practice of some kind, but nothing like what we would associate with a synagogue today.
Right. Now, in English, the name of the novel is The Orchard. Why is it called The Orchard?
Well, so in Hebrew, the novel is called The Orchard of Akiva, and the central character in The Orchard is Rabbi Akiva. And there's a famous story in the Talmud, a cryptic story, about four sages who enter an orchard. Now, an orchard in Hebrew is pardes, which also is related to the word paradise, and I think a word in Persian that is very similar. And so there's an idea that, you know, well, maybe it's an orchard like with trees, but there's an understanding that it's a mystical, occultic sort of orchard, right? That there's some kind of mysterious place. The story, the famous story in Judaism from the Talmud, is that four sages entered into this orchard, and one of them died, one of them went insane, one of them became a heretic, and one of them, Akiva, only Akiva, came out in one piece. And nobody knows, the Talmud is extremely unclear about what this orchard was, what happened there, why did it have these effects on these people. And it doesn't really give us any, or there's a few other pieces to the story, other very cryptic statements, right? The story has been around for a long time. It's kind of, in some way, been very, it's one of those stories that people tell and have not forgotten, and yet there's so little information about it. And so one of the agendas of the novel is to hypothesize what might have happened in that orchard, or what might these sages have seen that would have had such a dramatic effect on them, and also to question, did Rabbi Akiva actually come out in one piece or not, or was Rabbi Akiva also damaged in some way? And it's a spoiler to tell you what the answer is from the book, because it happens pretty late in the book, but the book does actually tell the reader what happens, what they saw in that orchard, and what had that effect. And it it would have that effect if that's really what they saw. Like, it's a very interesting and clever solution to describing what might have happened there that would have had this momentous effect on these sages, and also that would have made what they saw there so significant that we continue to tell the story 2,000 years later, even though, you know, we haven't known what happened there. So it's a really incredible dimension of the book that I shouldn't go into.
No spoilers. Okay, now, so the central character is Rabbi Akiva, and he's surrounded by a constellation of other people. What can you tell us about the rabbi?
Well, so Rabbi Akiva is kind of one of these huge, enormous, important figures that's associated with the beginnings of Rabbinic Judaism. In fact, there's a famous story in the Talmud where when Moses is on Mount Sinai receiving the Torah from God, and, you know, in the original on Mount Sinai right after the Exodus, you know, it's sort of a interpretation of what's going on there, a midrash, which is kind of an additional story that's kind of told about that period. So the Talmud tells the story that Moses is sort of waiting around, and God is just kind of decorating the letters of as he's writing the Torah, and Moses is getting impatient, like, why is God taking so long to write each letter? Why is he decorating them with these little crowns on the top of the letters? And God says, ultimately, the reason that I'm doing it is because this man Akiva is going to come in a few thousand years, and he's going to interpret many, many ideas and laws from each decoration on the letter. You know, there's some idea that Akiva was this enormously creative, enormously significant person who essentially created Rabbinic Judaism out of his interpretation of the Torah. But that his interpretation was so creative and so incredibly significant that the only way that you could explain it is that he wasn't even only interpreting the words, he must have been also interpreting the design of the letters, you know, because and the point is that he added so much, right? Either he created it out of whole cloth, or we're going to have to find some way to explain that it was really an interpretation when that's really hard to do. So that's the kind of the level of significance that Akiva has in Rabbinic Judaism. And the interesting story that's told about Akiva in the Talmud is that he was a ignorant, illiterate shepherd until the age of 40, that he didn't study anything, he couldn't even read. He was the child of converts, so he, you know, didn't even grow up culturally Jewish. And this is the guy who creates Rabbinic Judaism, who creates the Judaism that we inhabit today. And that the way that he was kind of discovered was that a woman who was the daughter of a very, very wealthy man who was the supervisor, you know, who Akiva worked for this man as his shepherd, and his daughter saw in him this potential, this incredible mind, and she taught him to read, and she pushed him to go and study and become a rabbi. And, you know, sort of it was thanks to her this incredible creator was discovered. You know, so the book kind of tells the story of Akiva, you know, who he was and how did he go from being this illiterate shepherd to becoming Rabbi Akiva, and also of his wife, who was this woman. Her name is Rachel in myth, and how did she come to see him as for the potential that he held. And I think what the book does that's really interesting too is that although the story of Rachel discovering Akiva is told in the Talmud, very, very little else is said about Rachel, as is common in the Talmud and in most books of that time, that the women's perspective is not really given. And this book kind of explores, well, what would Rachel's life have been if the story is true? And, you know, one of the really interesting dimensions of it is that, well, if he had gone off to study and become a rabbi, that means she was abandoned, and that means she would have had to provide for the family, and what would that have been like? And ultimately, you know, the story is one in which Rachel suffers a great deal in order to sort of bring about this revolution for Judaism.
Oh, okay. Now, actually, can you give us an example of one of Rabbi Akiva's interpretations?
One characteristic of biblical poetry that's important to understand, you know, sort of from an academic standpoint, is that in biblical poetry, it's often the case that something is said twice. So Right. So there's an echo. And so you say, I'll sing a song to the Lord. I'll dance to the Lord with timbrels or whatever, you know, and it's really just the same thing said twice. And that's a characteristic of biblical poetry. So there's this one part of the Bible where it says that, you know, God came from Sinai and he also came from Paran or you know, whatever. And right. And, you know, sort of a typical interpretation of that would be something like, you know, well, he came from one place and he went around and then he also came from the other place, you know, and you just kind of find some way to reconcile the two or just say, well, that's how poetry is. And it's just kind of echoing. Akiva in the book and in the Talmud kind of interprets this to say that what's being described here is essentially that he's coming from one place to the other. And where do we see that a person walks from one place to the other? It's when a groom walks down the aisle at his wedding. And so if this is how it's being described that God was doing when he gave the Torah, it must be that when the Torah was given, it was actually God marrying the Jewish people, right? And that because God has married the Jewish people, we have a relationship with God that is of a nature of a marriage, right? And that therefore, you know, either we are more special than other people or we have more responsibility or whatever the exact idea is coming out from there, you know, Akiva is just taking some really what really is probably a meaningless piece of poetry from the Bible that was just meant to sort of emphasize a point, and he's deriving some huge new idea out of it. You know, in the book, I think this particular part establishes, you know, why we can't include the Nazarenes or the Christians into the Jewish community, because only we married God, right? You know, and kind of one of these things where they're doing a very momentous thing, which is sort of dividing the Jews and the Christians based on this very obscure sort of way of interpreting.
Oh, okay. It sounds a bit like allegorical interpretation or something.
Yeah, it's in that zone, although I think it's much more about wordplay than allegory, you know, and that's the characteristic of Akiva.
Now, Akiva is surrounded by a whole cast of characters in the novel. Can you tell us a bit more about the other rabbis?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting group. And one of the things that I think is really special about the book is that a lot of these rabbis, you hear various little stories about them, but the Talmud doesn't connect them, right? The Talmud is not a historical document, and it's not really even a storytelling document. It's a hodgepodge type of document that includes a lot of little stories. So, you know, scattered throughout the thousands of pages of the Talmud are these little snippets of stories of these different rabbis. And at least speaking for myself, having studied it for so many years, I never thought of these rabbis as characters, you know. And so there would be a story here about Rabbi Eliezer and a story here about Rabbi Eliezer, but like it never really kind of hit me that it was the same guy, because these are in completely different places. And there was never sort of any sense of like, who is this person as a character? So one of the things that the novel does is it really sort of paints these rabbis as characters. There's a number of interesting sort of character types here, right? So there are some rabbis who are from priestly families. And in a certain way, right, these are the ones whose world is being rocked the most, because in the previous form of Judaism, they were the top of the top, but now they're just kind of one of the people. And there's some jockeying in the book about, you know, well, the rabbis that used to be priests, you know, they're sort of still trying to establish some rules and regulations that would kind of make things accord with their view. And Akiva, here's this upstart who is like not even, who's barely a Jew. And he's trying to tell us that we're not at the top anymore, you know, and there's that's sort of an interesting dimension that's brought. So there are two schools of thought in early rabbinic Judaism that are known as the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai. And these are kind of the more liberal and the more conservative schools of thought. So one of the other major themes of the book is to look at the different rabbis and how they line up in it, through these schools. You know, and these are some of the sort of famous names from Jewish lore, but people don't really know them as characters. So there's a rabbi named Rabbi Joshua, who's part of the school of Hillel, and a rabbi named Rabbi Eliezer, who's part of the school of Shammai, you know, and there's a lot of these characters that sort of sort themselves out. One of the most interesting characters and a significant character in this book, as well as in the other most famous novel of the Talmudic period, which is called As a Driven Leaf, which I believe was written in like the 1950s. The main character there and a very important character here is a rabbi named Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya. And he is known in Jewish lore as, quote, the other. In other words, he was excommunicated from the Talmud such that they don't even say his name. They only refer to him as the other because he was some kind of apostate, some kind of heretic. Right? He is one of the four that went into the orchard, into the Pardes, and he's the one who came out as an apostate, hating God, as a heretic. And, you know, it's interesting because both this book and As a Driven Leaf paint him in a very positive light and really try to understand him as a human being. And why would somebody start as a rabbi and come to become a heretic and to hate God? And how can we see him as a person who really was struggling and came to a certain conclusion? And so he's a very interesting character in this book.
But we don't know much about him.
We don't know much for, you know, two reasons, right? One is that we don't know much about a lot of the folks in the Talmud because there's not that many stories. But the other is because he was really, you know, the Talmud tried to excommunicate him, to try to like blot him out. And there are a few stories where they couldn't because he was known to be one of the four that went into the Pardes, for example. And so instead they refer to him as Acher or the other.
Yeah. He couldn't be a proxy for St. Paul, could he?
You know, who knows? Anything's possible. He's not, I've never heard that, but it's really interesting to think whether some of the early Christians might have been some of these folks. It's really interesting.
Yeah, what interests me about the period is the new structures crystallizing out of Judaism and the new social groups of which the Jesus clubs would have been just one group and how they eventually crystallized out to form a completely different set of factions and structures compared to the Second Temple period.
Right. And and it's interesting because there were, I think, two kinds of Jesus clubs, right? There were the Jews who had Jesus clubs and there were the Gentiles who had Jesus clubs. And one of the themes in this book is the response of the early rabbinic Jews to the Jesus clubs, the Jewish Jesus clubs, and to say, should we accept them as one form of Judaism, or should we divide from them? And I think that ultimately in the book and in real life, they decided to divide from them. And I think that at that point, the Jewish Jesus clubs sort of, I don't know, you know probably better than I what happened to them. I mean, they certainly didn't become the dominant place from which Christianity grew. I don't know if they sort of faded away or if they ultimately somehow merged with the Gentiles.
One of the things I found in my podcast is that sometimes I'll have a question, and to me it seems like a really big question, and when I try and investigate it, I find nothing. No one else seems to regard it as a big question. There seems to be no research about it. There seems to be nothing. So one of these questions is, to me, everything we know about all the books of the New Testament is that they were written in Greek. Every single fragment of papyrus we have, even the very earliest, is written in Greek. We have nothing in Hebrew and Aramaic. So to me, that says that the Jewish versions of the Jesus clubs disappeared very, very, very early, and it became a mission purely to the Gentiles. But I've never seen anyone comment on that fact. I mean, why don't we have Aramaic or Hebrew scraps? And as you say, what happened to the Jesus Club faction, which was led by Peter and James the Just? It must have gone very, very quickly.
Or they didn't create texts, right? That the texts were written by at that time by elites, right? By scribes. And I wonder if I don't know if we know anything about the Jewish Jesus clubs, but perhaps they were people from the lower classes.
That's entirely a possibility. That's entirely a possibility. Perhaps they did have texts, but they just haven't survived.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought by the time of the the second revolt, the Bar Kokhba revolt, they would have been extinct.
Right. But it's interesting, right? Because, and this is something that you covered on History in the Bible, the fact that, for example, the Book of Jubilees, I think, right, and a lot of those other parabiblical literature, that unless, if the Dead Sea Scrolls hadn't been discovered, we would have thought that they didn't exist in Hebrew or Aramaic, but it turns out that they did. And but the only reason that we know that is because they happen to have been important to a particular group of people who lived in a particularly good place for preserving papyrus or documents, and they survived, and then they were found. And so the thing is, it's possible that there were these Hebrew Christian texts and they just kind of didn't survive. But I think you're right, that must mean that if they existed, they only existed for a very short period of time.
Yes. I find it interesting that in rabbinic Judaism, as far as I know, there is zero evidence of influence of the vast apocalyptic literature, which, thanks to discoveries in the mid-20th century, we now know was all over the place, books like Jubilees and First Enoch. They must have been not major movements, but they were at least a sort of rivals to the Essenes or the Sadducees and Pharisees. But none of that went through to rabbinic Judaism, did it?
You know, I think I'm not a big enough expert to know, but I think, you know, it seems not, and I take your word for it. I mean, I think that you've done a lot of better research there than I have. You know, it raises for me one of these questions that our guest on Judaism Unbound, Barbara Tita, had brought up, which was raising the question of how much of the history that we believe is history about the origins of Judaism, how much of it is real history? You know, how much of it really happened? Because the first Jewish texts that I think that we have from the post-destruction period is the Mishnah, which was codified in something like the year 200. And so from the year 70 until the year 200, we have, you know, over 100 years that we don't really have texts. So the question becomes, you know, was there really this period of experimentation and of creation of something new during this period, which was close to the time when the various apocalyptic Second Temple literature was written, and that somehow that stuff was just ignored and the rabbis were just interested in something else? Or is it possible that rabbinic Judaism was really formed, you know, 100 years later, by which time that literature may have already kind of been lost or been associated with Christianity in some way, and that the rabbinic Judaism really, that it was much more discontinuous than we imagine it to be, that it wasn't people who just like left Jerusalem? And, you know, the story is the famous story, and this novel has this story in it, that there was a great rabbi named Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, and he was the last of the students of Hillel, who was the previous generation. And that when Jerusalem was destroyed, or right before Jerusalem was destroyed, he kind of knew that it was coming, and he had himself smuggled out of Jerusalem in a coffin, which is also kind of symbolic, right, of the death of the previous form of Judaism. He smuggles himself out of Jerusalem in a coffin, and he is taken to Vespasian, who is the Roman general at that time, who is leading the siege of Jerusalem. And Yochanan ben Zakkai has some kind of vision, and he tells Vespasian that he's going to become the Caesar. And then very soon thereafter, Vespasian is told that the Caesar is dead and that he has actually been chosen as the new Caesar. And he somehow recognizes Yochanan ben Zakkai as some kind of a prophet, and he grants him a wish or some wishes. And Yochanan ben Zakkai's primary wish is that he wants to be given the city of Yavne or Yamnia and its sages. And there's an idea of, and Yavne or Yamnia becomes known as the birthplace of rabbinic Judaism in legend, right? In memory. Now the question is, did that really happen? Right. And our guest Barbara Tita raised a lot of questions about that and said, you know, we don't really have any evidence other than that story in the Talmud that anything was happening in Yavne, other than it was some kind of a Roman garrison town. There was no evidence that there was a academy of Jewish sages there. So it's very possible that this entire history, this entire early history of rabbinic Judaism is nothing but a Talmudic legend that was written, you know, 100 or more years later. So it's really interesting to wonder, you know, because like you say, if Yavne really did exist at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, you would expect that that apocalyptic literature would have been part of the game there and would have taken a more significant place in Judaism. So it's a really interesting, you know, it's almost like, you know, was that kind of evidence that the dog didn't bark? So you know, I wonder.
It is a good question, isn't it? I suppose if we knew more about how the Book of Daniel managed to make it into the Bible, into the Tanakh, because that's the only thing which is anything like apocalyptic in the Hebrew texts. And it's only half an apocalyptic book, really, isn't it? I mean, the first half is a cutesy little folktale, people being trialed, and it's only the second half which is an apocalypse. So I wonder, did the rabbis know about all the swirling apocalyptic literature and thought, no, this is all just comic book stuff, but if we eliminate it entirely, then people will be going, hey, where's the Superman comics, guys? Because we know they exist. So we'll just have this little bit in Daniel. Maybe it's that. I don't know.
Is Daniel the one? Is it Daniel that kind of, in some ways, is kind of a Hasmonean time document that kind of paints the Hasmoneans in a positive light?
It was written in the very early stages of the Hasmonean revolution, insurgency. Because there are bits in Daniel which you can date to the time of Antiochus IV, who's the guy that Mattathias rebelled against. So the very earliest stages of the Hasmonean times. So it was written no later than then.
I mean, because I kind of have some theories about the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, that they, during the time of their political dominance, that they were propagandists who really liked to, you know, have the literature and the holidays that really emphasized their rule. And the rabbis didn't think much of the Hasmoneans. They didn't like them, but they didn't want to erase their literature. So they would reinterpret it, but they didn't get rid of it. Oh. Because, you know, so famously is Hanukkah, as a holiday, not a text, but that Hanukkah was clearly the Hasmoneans' kind of Independence Day, their holiday that celebrated their victory. And the rabbis didn't get rid of Hanukkah, but they reinterpreted it as that it was mostly about this miracle of a candle that, or, you know, oil that didn't run out, even though it was only enough for one day, but it lasted for 8 days. You know, so they kind of de-emphasized the Hasmoneans, but they preserved their holiday. And my, you know, theory has always been, it's kind of like, what if there would be some change in the world today, you know, in America, and, you know, if they tried to get rid of Thanksgiving, you know, people would be very annoyed about it. People in America like Thanksgiving. But if you want to reinterpret it and say it wasn't about the first time the Native Americans and the English sat down for a meal, you know, people would probably be okay with it if we gave it a different interpretation. But let's not get rid of Thanksgiving because we like it, because it's a good time for us to get together with family. So I think that there's the texts that kind of were in the canon at the time of the Hasmoneans, or at the time, you know, whenever sort of a key part of the Jewish canon was established, the rabbis didn't want to get rid of those, but they found other uses for them.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. I suppose I hadn't picked up on the reinterpretation of Hanukkah as a miracle holiday, I suppose, with the everlasting oil and that sort of thing. In my head, it's always been Hasmonean Victory Day.
Yeah, so it's very clear in the Talmud that the rabbis do everything that they can to de-emphasize the Hasmonean victory, and actually that the Hasmonean victory has come back as a key element of Hanukkah in the 20th century, largely because it served the sort of national political needs of the Israelis, because they were looking for a holiday that where Jews won, basically. And so there aren't that many. And in America, you know, in the early mid 20th century, when the Jews in America felt not included, and that there was anti-Semitism, and that also this idea that we had heroes of our own was valuable from a kind of
pride standpoint. And so in both places, the Hasmoneans were kind of re-emphasized again, but that was a 20th century innovation. From the first century to the 19th century, pretty much the Hasmoneans were highly de-emphasized in Judaism.
Well, that I didn't know. Okay, that's very interesting. And actually, that's a prime example of reinterpreting things, isn't it? Huh.
Yep, reinterpreting them twice, you know, because they got reinterpreted out and then back in again.
Yeah, and who knows what further interpretations may be made.
Right, right. I hope they don't remain for long.
You're not keen on that one?
I'm not a fan of the Hasmoneans.
Now, what has struck, or sometimes struck me, is how bad the ancient governance of first the kingdom of Israel, then the kingdom of Judah, really was. I mean, there aren't that many kings which the Tanakh or the books of Maccabees portray as competent, excellent individuals.
I think in their defense, though, I think that there isn't a whole lot of history of good governance in the ancient world. You know, and even when there's effective, I mean, there's two issues. There's incompetent governance, which there's a lot of, and then there's also competent but brutal and ruthless, you know, which I think is often more common in places like the Roman Empire. So, you know, it's like, partly I agree that there's a lot of history of terrible governance of both kinds among the Judeans and the Israelites and everyone, but I would say sort of on the positive side, there's at least there were a lot of writers, prophets, scribes, and people who, you know, were trying to turn lemons into lemonade by writing some good literature critiquing those bad governors. And that's the stuff that's really survived. You know, it's like that's what I think is interesting about all this, right? Look, I mean, they were in a particularly terrible geographic location that was, you know, constantly putting tremendous pressure on the rulers, whoever they were. And, you know, they didn't do a great job of handling those pressures. But there were, you know, what's interesting is the literary community that, you know, and how did that come to be? Was that a creation of some of the kings that recognized the value of the art and the prophets? Or was that somehow, was there a strong community and who supported them? Right, that was able to sort of give rise to that literature that is really what the legacy has been, you know. And rabbinic Judaism clearly doubles down on that and says, right, because in a way, what rabbinic Judaism is all about is saying, in a period where we have no governance at all, right, we're not in charge of our own governance at all. It's only about the literature. And, you know, that's sort of the story of rabbinic Judaism, that it's a religion that's primarily about literature and almost not at all about social control from a political standpoint.
That's a very good point. I mean, the rabbinic literature pretty much drops historical narrative as a literary form, doesn't it? It stops talking about history.
Yeah, in fact, one of the ways in which at least the tradition has talked about the Talmud is that there's sort of no history in it, so that, you know, it's often talked about as a glorious thing that you can have a page of Talmud in which rabbis are debating points, and these rabbis lived hundreds of years apart from one another. And that's sort of seen as one of the virtues of rabbinic literature, that it creates this conversation across the ages. Well, I mean, I was going to say that it's not what the novel's about. It's not what was going on at the formation, but the truth is it is what the novel is about, right? Is that in a way the genius of Akiva is to see the text of the Torah, the Bible, as a starting point, not an ending point, and to see it as open to interpretation, open to further conversation, as opposed to what I think people are often taught in Judaism and in other religions, that, you know, the great interpreters lived in the past and ours is just to follow what they told us. For me, what's interesting about this section with Paul is that it's picking up on two tiny things, you know, one from the Talmud and one from the New Testament, the book of Acts, and it's turning them into this huge story. And I think it's really interesting, right, that there's this story in the Talmud that Rabbi Eliezer was arrested for minut, which is often translated as heresy, but it seems to have something to do with Christianity. And so there's some hint, some notion that Rabbi Eliezer had some kind of connection to Christianity, or at least that the Roman governor thought that he did. And on the and then the other little piece is that in the book of Acts, there's this story of St. Paul, that he comes to Jerusalem and he's attacked by the crowds, and his nephew saves him from the mob. And Yochi puts together these two snippets of stories to tell this whole story about how Paul is the uncle of Rabbi Eliezer, and they actually have this deep and significant relationship. And I think that there's a way in which what Yochi is trying to say in this book and to explore in this book in general is that there is a strong familial relationship between Judaism and Christianity, and that, like many familial relationships, it has the potential for tremendous pain and tremendous dispute about, you know, who's the true carrier of the truth, you know, and yet there's also this deep sense of connection, and that there's a tragedy in the separation between Judaism and Christianity, and that tragedy of separation has led to other tragedies down the road. And I think it's a pain, you know, there's a lot of pain in the book. You know, I think that it's, I don't know if this is what Yochi intended, but I felt that the wife of Rabbi Akiva, Rachel, in some way symbolizes the old Judaism, in the sense that she recognizes that it's going to have to be something new. And she recognizes that the genius is going to come from someone who's uneducated, someone who's not invested in the old way. And she actually identifies him and gives him the resources and gives him the permission to become and create something new. And she suffers terribly as a result of it. And she understands that in some way, this is also her doom. And so I mean, to me, it's a beautiful character, whether Yochi intended it quite this way or not, that Rachel in some way represents both the understanding that something new is needed and the understanding that that's going to sort of mean her own death or her own near death. And I think that also in the way that the book treats the relationship between Judaism and Christianity, there's also this navigation between the pain of family relationship, the pain of separation, and, you know, an effort to try to sort of understand perhaps what could have been if it had been otherwise.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting. Now, when you were translating this, did you find any particular issues or problems? Because you're obviously fluent in both Hebrew and English. So were there any really interesting challenges?
Yeah, it was very difficult in one special way, which is that according to, that Akiva's genius, at least according to the Jewish tradition, is largely a genius that has to do with wordplay. And to translate wordplay is very difficult.
Right.
Because the wordplay is different. And often in Hebrew, wordplay has to do with letters being doubled, or, you know, some way in which one word is a homophone for another. And, you know, one example that I talked about on our podcast too, but there's a scene in the book where Akiva is interpreting the famous quote from the Bible, "Love your neighbor as yourself." And he's trying to tell his wife that you should love your spouse as yourself. And in Hebrew, the word for neighbor or friend in that quote is re'acha, and the word for your spouse is rayatcha. And so it's, you can hear re'acha, rayatcha. It's a very similar sounding word, and there's really just sort of a one-letter difference. So the wordplay there is quite straightforward in Hebrew. Whereas in English, if I'm translating it as, you know, he's reading it, love your neighbor as yourself, and then he's saying, and therefore I understand you have to love your spouse as yourself, it like makes no sense, and it just seems like a non sequitur. So the challenge as a translator is to say, well, and at least my point of view was that the important thing here is to show that Akiva is playing with language and that he's creative and that he's finding ways of spinning out some linguistic matter into something with deep meaning. And so I actually sort of intentionally mistranslated that instead of saying love your spouse as yourself, he says love your favored as yourself, because my thinking there was that favored and neighbored rhyme. And so at least there's a sense that there's some similarity between the words. And then I added an extra sentence, right, where he says, and who do you favor the most, if not your spouse, or something like that, right? So you kind of capture the point that's trying to be made there without directly translating. And that what that means, though, is then is that if somebody is reading it in English and sort of thinks that they are getting the exact linguistic gamesmanship that Akiva is doing, they're not, you know, and that's a difficult thing to say, you know, so that readers of the book shouldn't imagine that they necessarily know exactly what Akiva's creativity was there, but hopefully they understand that his superpower, such as it is this incredible linguistic creativity, even if they're not getting the exact way that it's done, but they're experiencing it. So that was a real challenge in doing this.
Were there ever times when you were pulling your hair out, or were you treating it as sort of a really intriguing puzzle?
It was mostly a really intriguing puzzle. I mean, it was one really almost pull your hair out part was that in the very beginning, when Akiva's wife, Rachel, is sort of recognizing his genius, there's this kind of a last will and testament, a one-line will that he is trying to interpret. And the way to, the sort of secret to his interpretation has to do with moving a comma from one place to another place. And so that changes the way that the sentence is read. And, you know, you just had to find just the right way to write this sentence in English so that, you know, moving a comma would change the meaning of the sentence. You know, it has to be substantially different in English than Hebrew. So it was, you know, and it's not that easy in English, since, you know, English is just a much more, the grammar is sort of much more complex. And so it's hard, it's a lot harder to write a sentence like that in English. So I remember spending quite a while trying to figure that one out.
It must have been a very challenging and fun project.
It was a lot of fun. And it, for me, the real exciting part was getting to know the characters and getting to see how these stories that I had known many of them, not all, but as you start to see, whoa, that story, you know, I didn't even realize that the character, you know, the sort of peripheral character in that story was this rabbi that I knew something else about, and it starts to be consistent. And in fact, one of the really interesting scenes in the book has to do with the first ever Passover Seder. Passover Seder that most Jews are used to attending today when they open up the Haggadah, which is kind of the guide to a Passover Seder. There are a lot of these little stories of rabbis talking to each other and interpreting different passages from the Bible that have to do with the Exodus. And it's all very kind of arcane, and most Jews that are having a Passover Seder just skip that part. Like, nobody really understands what it's really there for. And Yochi spends a good chunk of time explaining that scene, basically, and it's showing how these rabbis are sitting down to the first Passover Seder after the destruction of the temple, and are really trying to figure out what should we do now that there's no time? What should the Seder look like? And so each of those elements is explained, and it's also very consistent with the characters that she's drawn in the book over time. So now when I sit down to Passover Seder and you read those parts, all of a sudden it has real meaning, and you kind of realize it's not just these names of rabbis that are making sort of irrelevant and out of nowhere kind of comments. You're actually sitting there and you're kind of understanding, I understand why this rabbi was reading it this way. And, you know, I understand what's going on here. So that was a really exciting part for me to sort of put together all kinds of elements of Judaism that I'd sort of experienced or heard, but not really sort of understood. I hope that'll be the experience for readers.
Now, is this one of the reasons why the book's been so popular in Israel?
I think that in Israel, the there's a little bit more than in America that some of these stories and some of these phrases from the Talmud have sort of crept into the culture. I suppose that it's, you can sort of understand, I'm not sure what they are off the top of my head, but, you know, there's various kinds of phrases or, you know, like spare the rod, spoil the child or something that, you know, we kind of, we know, like they're sort of in the zeitgeist in English, you know, you kind of, you know, where do they come from exactly? We don't know what, you know, and so a lot of ancient Jewish sort of phrases like that have sort of found their way into modern Hebrew. And so I think one of the cool things that this book does for Israelis is it kind of shows them the origins of these little things that they say every day, but don't really even know why they say them. I think that's a little bit less true in America, even among the American Jewish community, because the phrases don't have quite the same role in everyday conversation. So I think in Israel, there was an added level to that. But I think what's really interesting in America is just that we do know a lot of these stories, like the stories from the Passover Haggadah. And I think that, you know, to my mind, the early relationship between Judaism and Christianity is particularly interesting to Jews and Christians living in America and living in other countries outside of Israel. I just say in closing that there's very, very little literature, by which I mean novels and even short stories in English, and I think actually in Hebrew, about the Talmudic period. You know, it's funny, you're talking about the apocalyptic literature, you know, but here's this period of 2,000 years or so of Jewish history, and there's very little literature other than religious literature written about it. And whereas we seem to have a lot of biblical novels, and we have a lot of, in the rabbinic period, there is a lot of midrash, a lot of retellings of the biblical stories in the Talmud or in other literature. So it feels like in many ways we know the Bible very, very well, even though the Bible is not really, and here I mean the Old Testament, is not really the foundation of Judaism or Christianity. And you know, I always think it's really interesting when Christian friends of mine talk, and they sort of talk as if Judaism is really based on the Bible. And Judaism is not based on the Bible. Judaism is based on the Talmud, just as Christianity is also not based on the Old Testament, it's based on the New Testament. And it's remarkable that we know so much about the Bible, but we know so little about the characters that are the ones who really created the Judaism that we still inhabit. And I don't know if that's equally true about Christianity. I think to a large extent it is, right? Because we know the stories of Jesus, but we don't really know the stories of the people who kind of put together the actual Christian practices that are dominant in the world, right? And so, you know, I think what this book contributes is a little bit of a step in the direction of being able to understand some of the forces that were in play, and also some of the human beings, at least as we know them in legend, who were the early creators of the Judaism that we actually have and that we actually know. And also there's some in the book about the Christianity that we know. So I really think that one of the most exciting things for me is about this book is that it exists, you know, that it's, yeah. You know, that it's one more piece of information that some of us can get to sort of try to wrap our minds around what this whole thing is all about. And the last thing I'll say is that the reason why I really wanted to translate this book and to have this book available to English speaking readers is because of its making clear just how revolutionary the development of rabbinic Judaism was as compared to the Second Temple Judaism that preceded it. Because for me, I do think that there's some sense where people are afraid to make changes today, even though the Judaism that we have is not working for a lot of people, but they think that it's the way that it kind of has to be. And there's part of me that feels that if we could establish that the Judaism that we have was a major departure from the Judaism that preceded it, and that it needed to be because of the change of various social circumstances. And it wasn't only the destruction of the Second Temple. It was all kinds of other reasons that sacrificial cult-based Judaism wasn't working, that today we could be more bold and more willing to take some experimental chances with Judaism today. So that's, for me, that's kind of what's at stake in having this available out there.
Okay, so to use a cliche, today's Judaism isn't written in stone.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, thank you, Dan, for that. And I hope that the book sells well in English.
Thank you. I hope so too.
And is very illuminating for a lot of people.
No. Well, thanks so much for having me on and having me to talk about it. I do tell everybody that I appreciate that people enjoy my podcast, that I always tell people my favorite podcast is History in the Bible.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. And people, remember to listen to Judaism Unbound.
Thanks for listening. For maps, charts, and diagrams, check out my website, www.historyinthebible.com.